Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A lot of eyebrows went sky high when, in the midst of Super Bowl mania last weekend, Fox's Bill O'Reilly told President Trump Russia's Vladimir Putin is a killer. And the president turned the killer label right back on the United States, appeared to draw a moral equivalency with a Russian autocrat whose time has left a trail of dead opponents. Michael McFaul knows Russia well. He was U.S. ambassador to Moscow under President Obama, worked on the National Security Council, was there when the last administration tried a reset with Russia and failed. He's sounding big warnings on Trump and Putin. This hour on Point, Michael McFaul on Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and the U.S. relationship with Russia. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you think of the O'Reilly-Trump encounter, the president's response? Where does Trump's White House go with Russia? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen just for a moment to the exchange that has put this relationship, Trump and Putin, back in the spotlight again. This interview was a broadcast Sunday afternoon. President Trump and Bill O'Reilly, there they were. We all, many of us watched or have seen it since. Here we go.
Do you respect Putin?
I do respect him.
Do you? Why?
Well, I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, and Islamic terrorism all over the world,
right?
Major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. You got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
You think our country's so innocent? A kind of moral equivalency drawn there. Republican Senator John McCain pushed back hard on Tuesday.
I repeat, there is no moral equivalent between that butcher and thug and KGB colonel and the United States of America, the country that Ronald Reagan used to call a shining city on a hill. And to allege some kind of moral equivalence between the two is either terribly misinformed or incredibly biased.
And here was retired U.S. Army General Barry McCaffrey on MSNBC.
One can argue that's the most anti-American statement ever made by the President of the United States, to confuse American values with Putin, who's running a criminal oligarchy, who kills people abroad and at home, who imprisons journalists and takes away business property, who shares it with his former KGB agents, who invades and seizes Crimea and eastern Ukraine. This is an astonishing state of affairs. Hard to know what to think about it.
It is hard to know what to think about it. Let's turn to someone who knows Russia well and the U.S. relationship with Russia well. Joining us now from Stanford, California, Ambassador Michael McFaul. Under President Obama, he served on the National Security Council as Senior Director for Russian and Eurasian Affairs, and he served as U.S. Ambassador to Moscow from 2012 to 2014. He published an opinion piece this week in the Washington Post headlined, "We Can't Let Trump Go Down Putin's Path," which gives you an idea of where he's coming from. You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Ambassador Michael McFaul, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What did you make of that exchange between Bill O'Reilly and President Trump?
I was shocked, if you want to know the truth. I mean, it's not empirically correct. We don't use force in the same ways that the Russians do when they're fighting. Anybody who's seen what's happened to Aleppo, for instance, knows how the Russians fight terrorism. It's not true with respect to what happens internally, as both, I think, Senator McCain and General McCaffrey alluded to. Opposition leaders in Russia have been assassinated. One is poisoned right now. Vladimir Kara-Murza is his name. I know him well. He's sitting in a hospital right now because he's been poisoned. So
unconscious, or in a coma, we're told.
He's in a coma, yes. So it's empirically not true. But even if it were, just for the sake of argument, right? And some people might argue that we do a lot of killing. You know, that is an argument you hear in Moscow a lot. It's called whataboutism. In fact, there's a whole tactic in the Russian media that they use it. Even if it were true, as the commander in chief, he can't say that. He can't disrespect those people because later in the clip, just so you know, he talks about Iraq. So it's very clear that he's talking about our killing in places like Iraq. And it is true that we do killings in Iraq. But the person that orders that is the commander in chief. It's not soldiers. It's not killers. It's the government. And so I just think it sends a very bad signal to those people. In fact, I can tell you it does because on my Twitter feed after he made that comment, and I commented how I thought it was disrespectful, I had many veterans weigh in to agree with me.
What do you mean about the way Russians fight and terrorism, for example, or the way Americans do that? I mean, we've all read and we've talked, and we'll talk more on this show about the raid in Yemen that happened late in January, the U.S. Navy SEALs there, and we're told that a dozen or two, the reports are still unclear, but there's terrible images coming out. Women and children died in that. What's the difference, Ambassador?
Well, I want to be clear. The use of force, the word killer is a difficult one for me to keep using, even with respect to President Putin, by the way. And I do think it's inappropriate for the President of the United States, who must conduct business with the President of Russia and other countries, to use a word like that. So there, well, I'm somewhat
sympathetic. O'Reilly raised it, not the President. Right?
Yes. And that put him in an awkward position. So I want to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. But having acknowledged that, I also want to say, secondly, do we use force? Have we gone to war? And do we make mistakes and kill innocent people? That is true, too. That is absolutely true. And that's a tragic truth. But third, I think that there's a big difference between the way we are fighting terrorism, including even in Yemen, and the way the Russians fight. If you look at what happened in Aleppo, many people have called that a crime against humanity, that there were war crimes conducted there because they were just bombing the city to smithereens.
Day after day after week after week.
Exactly. Allied, by the way, with President Assad, who has also slaughtered hundreds of thousands of his own people, civilians of his own country, in this so-called fight against terrorism. We don't do that. Maybe we've done that in the past. And I think that's important to acknowledge as well. But most certainly in the Obama administration, we don't fight that way. And that is a fundamental difference between the United States of America and Russia.
Take it home to the home front in Russia. The suggestion, again, of an equivalency here. You heard General McCaffrey there saying, look, American values are not Russian values under Vladimir Putin. You've got a criminal oligarch, he said, kills people abroad and at home, imprisons journalists, takes away business property. What about, I mean, you say you object perhaps to the word killer for Vladimir Putin. John McCain calls him a butcher. Now, that could be, you know, we can get into all kinds of weeds about that. But what about the list of opponents to Vladimir Putin who are now dead?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right to infer that they have a different system of government, an autocratic system of government. And for all of our faults and the possible threats to our democratic institutions today, to compare our system to the Russian system is just wrong. It's empirically incorrect, putting on my social science hat from Stanford University here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's normatively incorrect, speaking as a former U.S. government official. It's just wrong. And then within that, there have been many people that have been imprisoned falsely, in my view. They have been harassed falsely, in my view. They've been charged with crimes falsely, in my view, because they are opposition leaders. And most tragically, on occasion, people have been killed. Just 2 years ago, Boris Nemtsov, the leader of the opposition at the time, one of the most outspoken critics of the Kremlin, was assassinated just a few hundred yards from the Kremlin walls. Now, I want to be careful here. I cannot say to you definitively that Putin ordered that assassination. It's the facts are too murky. It's, you know, and to make that allegation, I'm not prepared to do that in a way that other people are. But it was a political assassination.
And
nobody
hardly the only
that.
One. I mean, you can go
and
back.
Hardly the only one. There's been many more, including, you know, abroad, as one of the clips you played alluded to, when Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned living in London. You know, and that, I think, by most accounts, everybody believes that was the Kremlin.
You wrote in the Washington Post, we can't let, or the headline was, we can't let Trump go down Putin's path. And you look at this exchange with O'Reilly, you say a more worrisome interpretation is that Trump admires Putin's policies and ideas and may even seek to emulate his method of rule. What are you warning of there?
Well, I added a lot of caveats too, because I don't want to get ahead of my skis here or jump the gun. But I know, you know, if you go back and you look at Russian history, when President Putin was elected, by the way, you know, for the first time ever, he'd never run for elected office, and suddenly he was elected in March of 2000. We didn't know a lot about his policies. We knew about his background, but he didn't have much government experience. And in those early years and even early months, there was some assaults, you know, criticism. I mean, not unlike what we're hearing today, where he said, for instance, the press is an enemy. The press is not representing the Russian state. And over time, incrementally, he rolled back the independence of the Russian media, including seizing control of the two largest national independent media stations. And the debate at the time, I remember it very vividly because I was in that debate, was like, well, this is no big deal. Putin, after all, needed to end the carnage and the chaos of the 90s, and we need a strong hand now to push us forward with respect to economic policy. And to his credit, President Putin did put in place economic policies, but it came at a terrible loss, that is, the loss of democracy. And I'm a little bit worried. I see some parallels to what President Trump talks about right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, about Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Trump's admiration, and America's way forward with Russia. You can join us this hour. Was the president right in the interview over the weekend to equate our country with Putin's Russia? Do you want a closer relationship to work with Russia? Are you afraid President Trump may try to follow Vladimir Putin's autocratic ways? What about what's going on in Ukraine right now? What about the president of the United States holding out the hope of cooperation in going after ISIS? Michael McFaul joins us from Stanford, California. He's out there now as a senior fellow at the Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute at the Hoover Institution, author of Russia's Unfinished Revolution. Michael McFaul, you say that when Vladimir Putin came to power in 2000, like Donald Trump, he'd never been elected, but here he was, and he said he would make America great again. Describe how the Putin government or rule went from, well, maybe this is all right, to people thinking, whoa, this is full-on autocracy.
Well, he meant make Russia great again, just to
excuse
be clear.
Excuse me. Make Russia great again. Pardon me, of course.
But it's I confuse it often myself when referring to President Trump. So, again, his deal was there had been this chaotic period in the 1990s and economic dislocation, one of the worst economic depressions that Russians had ever experienced. You know, chaos, non-rule of law, the borders were not secure, right? Specifically in Chechnya, which had declared its independence a couple of times in the 90s. So he said, I'm a rule of law guy, I'm a law and order guy, and I'm going to reestablish that rule of law here in Russia and make the economy grow. And just coincidentally, he came into power right at the time that energy prices were rising in the world. And so, you know, it happened on his watch.
They had a lot of natural gas and up went the wealth.
Right. And right before then, the prices were really depressed. They went up right as, it was a coincidence. Mm-hmm. And what happened over time, and then he did a couple other things I want to point out. He cut taxes. He promised to cut taxes. They now have a 13% flat income tax for individuals, and he cut corporate taxes by about 12 percentage points. And the deal was, let me be in power. You give up some of your political rights, and I'll bring order and economic growth. And for about a decade, that worked, and people took that trade-off. They decided that that was a good trade.
Okay.
And that's what, when I hear the debates today, they sound eerily similar to me to the debates I heard in Russia back in 2000.
And when did it begin to turn towards something darker, more autocratic?
Right away. First with the press. Just as, you hear a lot of criticism of the press these days, and they're not dishonest people, and they're an enemy of the state. That's exactly the way Putin talked about them.
You mean the way Donald Trump talks about them? Oh, the press.
Sorry.
All the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I'm confusing just like you did. Exactly. And that happened first. Down the road, he then constrained the competition in elections. And so elections still occur in Russia. There are still multiple candidates, but it's not a level playing field. And I think most analysts now agree with that. Then there was another terrorist attack, a very tragic terrorist attack in 2004. And in response to that, he ended direct elections for governors, the equivalent of they're called oblasts in Russia. They would be the equivalent of our states. And he said, as a way to strengthen our fight against terrorism, he stopped direct elections. And that, by the way, is my worst nightmare in terms of our own country, where we have some new cataclysmic event, and then we're asked by our government to give up some of our freedoms and liberties in exchange for another fight with terrorism. Having said all that, Tom, I need to really be careful. I in the piece, and I strongly believe this, there's a giant difference between Russia in 2000 and in America today. One, our institutions, our democratic institutions, are much more robust than they were in Russia in 2000. So that gives me hope.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, our society is much more capable of mobilizing against what people think are questions or steps away from democracy than Russian society was in 2000. Because Russian society had done that earlier in 1991 against the Soviet regime. Hundreds of thousands of people used to come out every 2 weeks on the streets of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and elsewhere to mobilize for democracy. I know. I was there. I was standing in those crowds.
Yep.
10 years later, they weren't ready to do that because they felt like democracy had not delivered.
I mean, you say first small steps toward autocracy at the beginning of a new presidency can produce momentum toward bigger autocratic changes later. We hear you. You're saying, look, we've got a much more robust civil society and democratic institutions here. There's one more angle I want to go to talk about, just because, and it can seem frivolous or just kind of, what the heck? But Donald Trump going after Nordstrom's for dropping his daughter Ivanka's line of accessories and clothing. I mean, you point out that in Russia, Vladimir Putin went very hard after business leaders who crossed him.
That's right, because that was part of another independent part of the Russian political system, the so-called oligarchs. And one in particular that he arrested in October 2003, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, at the time the richest Russian, he was supplying support to the opposition. Like that's how it's supposed to work, by the way, in democracies. People are supposed to be able to support individual candidates. And he was doing that too much, and so Putin put him in jail for 10 years.
So here we are. And you're saying big differences, but yet some things to watch out for here. Even as we speak, more criticism coming. We've got Ben Cardin out of Maryland and Senator Bob Corker at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today condemning that moral equivalency kind of comments that the President of the United States made about Vladimir Putin and the two countries. What's your advice to – I want to turn and look at what we might do with Russia abroad, but your advice to Americans at home?
Well, just be vigilant. I'm not one of those that are in the camp that says we're turning towards autocracy tomorrow. I believe strongly in American institutions and the American people, but investing now to protect those liberties will be a good investment for preserving them down the road. The story of Russia is that incremental changes allowed for much bigger changes to roll back democracy in Russia.
Let's look at these two countries then internationally. President Trump's suggestion is that a better relationship with Moscow may have benefits for the United States around the world, particularly in regard to ISIS. How do you see that assertion?
Well, let me just say at the level of 30,000 feet, there's one place where I agree with President Trump, that if it's in the national interest of the United States of America to work with Russia on a common national security interest or economic interest, we should try to do that. After all, that's exactly what I did and what President Obama did in the early days of his administration. And we got some really big deals, to paraphrase President Trump, mm-hmm. done. You know, we got the START Treaty. We got rid of a lot of nuclear weapons. We got sanctions on Iran. We got Russia into the World Trade Organization. We opened up a supply route to Afghanistan so that we could be more proactive against our fight against terrorism in Pakistan. Because back then, we were dependent on Pakistan. Almost 95% of our supplies, if I remember correctly, went through Pakistan. Mm-hmm. We changed that because of cooperation with Russia. That allowed us to go in and kill Osama bin Laden. So I'm not against it abstractly when he says, wouldn't it be great to get along? But I think he's got objectives and means mixed up, which is to say, President Trump always says, I want to get along with Putin, as if that's the objective of his policy. In my view, the objective should be something like fighting ISIS, and let's get to that in a minute. I'm going to tell you how hard that's going to be with Russia.
Okay.
But or trade, or, you know, it should be some outcome that's in our national interest. And the means should be, you know, calling Putin, engaging with Putin, just to get along in and of itself. Well, then what? Like, okay, so you have a nice tea at the Kremlin, but how does that benefit the American people?
Well, he said with O'Reilly to go after ISIS.
Yes. So let's talk about that. First of all, I want to remind your listeners that he's not the first person that said that. President Obama tried to do that in the summer of 2016, by the way. They even had long talks to try to set up what they called a joint implementation center to coordinate the fight against ISIS in Syria. But here are some of the problems. Number one, if we sign up with Russia to fight terrorism in places like Syria, we're also signing up to fight alongside President Assad, who's killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Because he's allied with Moscow.
Because he's allied with Moscow, hated by many millions of people in the Sunni world, governments and people alike. So the idea that somehow we ally with Assad and that's going to help our fight with terrorism, I'm skeptical about that. Nothing has inspired jihadists more than that war in Aleppo, than that just the bombing to rubble the city of Aleppo. Why are the jihadists going to Syria? Because they see those images. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, another ally we would pick up in that grand coalition is Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. They are in alliance with Russia and Mr. Assad fighting ISIS.
And Iran.
And then I was just going to get to Iran. And then Iran becomes your ally. Moreover, let's be clear, that alliance is not fighting ISIS in Syria. Every now and then they do, but the vast majority of the fighting that they've done so far have been against other organizations, some of which we would not call terrorists. And so we've got a big problem here about defining who is ISIS and who is not. And we actually, it's called Operation Inherent Resolve. Your listeners can go Google those three words and get the latest update. We, the United States and our allies, we are fighting ISIS in the eastern part of Syria and in Iraq. Mm-hmm. The Russians are not fighting ISIS because they have other objectives there. They want to preserve Assad. Fighting ISIS, they're happy to let us do it ourselves. So it sounds great as a bumper sticker, but when you drill into it, it's going to be rather difficult to have, I think, a working relationship with Russia against ISIS that actually helps us defeat ISIS.
Well, then what do you make of President Trump's repeated assertion that this is the primary quid pro quo that he would want from a relationship with Moscow, a better relationship with Moscow?
What I want is for President Trump to convene his National Security Council. I want him, rather than to sit in the Oval Office and tweet and do interviews, I want him to sit in that windowless room where I spent many, many hours when I worked at the White House, mm-hmm. And chair a meeting with Secretary Tillerson there, with Secretary Mattis there, obviously General Flynn as well, and do a deep dive about the things I just talked about. Because honestly, when I hear him say these things, it sounds like we're still in campaign mode. That's a great bumper sticker. You know, who doesn't want to fight ISIS? And wouldn't it be great to have more allies? But when you dig down into the actual problem, it looks a little differently. And so far, to the best of my knowledge, they haven't had that meeting. They haven't sat at the table across the room from each other and debated how would the American armed forces ally with Russia to fight ISIS. Because once you have that conversation, turns out that it's a lot harder than just a bumper sticker or soundbite.
It's pretty wild that that conversation has not taken place, even at this point, with all of the commentary from the president about Vladimir Putin and Russia. Ambassador Michael McFaul is with us, U.S. Ambassador to Moscow. Quite recently, actually. Lots of callers for you, Ambassador. Andre in Baltimore. Andre, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your question?
So I don't have a question. I just have a point. I just wanted to, I'm watching Fox News and I'm hearing them try and defend what he says. They're like, oh, maybe he meant this and, you know, perhaps it was that. And I just keep thinking to myself, I can't help but thinking after watching how they berated President Obama for even trying to talk to Russia. What would their reaction have been if Obama had said this very exact thing in this very exact way? It would be a rallying cry on the right. That's all I wanted to say.
Ambassador McFaul, thank you, Andre. Ambassador?
Well, Andre is exactly right. I mean, it would be a total outrage, 24/7 coverage. Obama is a communist, moral equivalency with those, you know, dictator, communist, socialists in Moscow. There is a giant double standard here. I totally agree. And I have been in some conversations, where I do hear this stretching. He actually meant, you know, our criminals in America when he said we got a lot of killers too. And I would just ask your listeners, go look at the whole tape. It's very obvious he's talking about the United States and Iraq. And I would just remind you, he said it on the campaign trail as well. And what disappoints me, frankly, with the president and my commander in chief, is I understand people say things during the heat of an election that maybe they don't really mean. But he doubled down on it. And he is now the commander in chief of the armed forces. And he needs those people to believe in him. He needs those people to feel that he has their back, not that he's comparing them to other countries. Even if it, you know, again, even if it may be true in some kind of academic sense, we could debate who kills more and how they kill. You don't rally the troops by making those kind of statements.
Megan in Detroit. Megan, you're on the air with Ambassador McFaul.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a comment and a question to the point of, you know, what you just said about doubling down on it. Like, you know, the campaign trail, and be that as it may, at this point now, as the current president, continuing on, you know, somewhat forcefully, I think it can be agreed on by most.
Cut to your question, Megan. It's short before the break here. What's on your mind? What's your question?
I guess, is there an investigation into, like, there? It seems to me obvious that there's some kind of, I don't know, strange connection. There's something that's not transparent, like much of his past. He doesn't want to reveal his tax returns, et cetera. His business interests, he's not separated from. His business interests in Russia specifically. I mean, by not being transparent, just like Putin was, probably able to ramp up as a result of his autocratic, I guess, seize of power or seize for power. Is there any work being done in terms of that, I guess, within, you know, these governments.
Megan, we'll come back and we'll look at it. And I appreciate your call from Detroit. Let me hold that question right through the break. I'll put it straight to Ambassador Michael McFaul. He joins us from Stanford today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, this hour about Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Trump's admiration there, and America's way forward with Russia. You can join us this hour. What do you see in this relationship, in the exchange between Bill O'Reilly and President Trump? Putin's a killer, so you think we're so innocent? Back and forth there. And what might be gained or lost in the Trump approach to Russia and Vladimir Putin? Long trail of comments here last July, talking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, then candidate Trump, said he was confident President Putin would not go into Ukraine. Of course, that might have been suspect at the time. And the recent spike in fighting in eastern Ukraine, that prediction looks pretty shaky. Candidate Trump also said if elected, candidate Trump said he'd consider recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea. Consider.
He's not going into Ukraine, okay? Just so you understand. He's not going to go into Ukraine. All right? You can mark it down. You can put it down. You can take it anywhere
you want.
Well,
he's already there, isn't he?
Okay. Well, he's there in a certain way, but I'm not there. You have Obama there. And frankly, that whole part of the world is a mess under Obama with all the strength that you're talking about and all of the power of NATO and all of this. In the meantime, he's going away. He takes Crimea. He's sort of, I mean.
But you said you might recognize that.
I'm going to take a look at it.
I'm going to take a look at it. And, you know, I'm not there. When I'm there, it'll be different. Well, there's a lot going on in Ukraine right now. We'll come to that. Ambassador McFaul, we had Megan calling from Detroit just before the break and asking about what is known or might be learned about Donald Trump's potential business interests in Moscow, how they might sway his view of the American relationship with Moscow or Vladimir Putin. And I guess I should ask you as well about, you know, the reports, and the president himself was briefed on this report, these reports, that the Kremlin has dirt on Donald Trump. What about those?
Well, the first point I want to make that Megan is alluding to is remember why we're discussing all that is because Russia meddled in our presidential election. They stole data. They then published that data to help one candidate win and to hurt the other candidate. That is crazy. That is unprecedented. I've never heard of that before in all of American history. And that we're just kind of moving on and forgetting about it as if it didn't really happen, no big deal.
It is amazing.
It's amazing. And that is what really concerns me. So, you know, all these things together, I believe very strongly that we need a bipartisan, independent investigation like we had with the 9/11 commission after that terrorist attack so that we have a greater ability to know all of the facts of what happened, including the things that Megan was alluding to, because I have 100 questions that we just don't know. And I'm really nervous that, you know, the government and the American people are just moving on and without thinking about preparing ourselves to be better defended against foreign actors in preserving the integrity of our elections come the 2020. I mean, what is more important to American sovereignty than that? And so I hope that we'll revisit that, and I hope that a commission like that will get set up.
And what about the concern or the reports that Russia may have some leverage over this president, some dirt?
So I don't know that. I can't vouch for that. I've obviously read the report, but I have a lot of questions about that.
I mean, these aren't just reports floating anywhere, right? He was briefed himself in Trump Tower on this by intelligence chiefs of the United States, right?
Correct. I also know that Russia uses disinformation very effectively. I've seen it, and I've worked with it when I was in the government. All I would say is this. to anybody traveling to Russia, you should know that they have incredible ability to surveil what you're doing, both in terms of your internet, voice, and video. Probably one of the most effective surveillance states in the world. I know because I had to live there 24/7 as ambassador, and we took tremendous precautions to try to keep things private that we needed to be private and secret. A guy like Donald Trump coming in 2013 for the Miss Universe pageant, would Russian intelligence services have a big interest in what he's doing there and seek to collect data on him? The answer to that is absolutely yes, and you're naive if you think otherwise. What I don't know, of course, and really feel uncomfortable speculating about is what they actually have. I find it a little curious, to be honest, knowing this world pretty well, that if they had such compromising material, that they would tell a private eye, that they would reveal that information. That information usually only works in terms of blackmail if you hold on to it. So I'm a little skeptical of some of those things in that report, but the overall question, should we know more about the business ties? I think there's just many, many questions we don't know, and that's why we need a commission to look into it.
Ambassador Michael McFaul was U.S. Ambassador to Moscow until 2014, joins us today from Stanford, California. Ambassador McFaul, stand by if you'd be good enough. Matthew Rojansky joins us as well right now. He's director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Matthew Rojansky, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You've expressed some openness to some changes in the U.S. relationship with Moscow and some benefit out of that. At the same time, President Trump's getting a lot of criticism from some quarters for his posture toward Vladimir Putin. How do you look at the opportunities or risks here, Matthew?
Well, I would say, first of all, Russia is a country the importance of which for U.S. Interests globally, everything from the security of our people here at home, our people abroad, our business interests, the security of our allies and important U.S. positions internationally. It just can't be overstated. The Russians are the only country on earth that can literally destroy this country, life as we know it on this planet in under an hour. But that's not the only issue. It's not just nuclear security. And obviously preserving an arms control regime with the Russians where we know what they have, they know what we have, and we keep it basically under wraps and try to keep it as minimal as possible is very important. But, the potential of cooperation on other issues, everything from trying to resolve regional conflicts, and it won't be easy. I agree with Mike about that. Ukraine won't be easy. Syria won't be easy. We have many divergent interests, but we do have common interests, to dealing with some of the kind of 21st century challenges. So trafficking, global health issues, issues of dealing with the simple reality of a global climate that's changing as it's pouring snow up there in New England. And yesterday was 68 degrees in Washington, D.C., adapting to that reality. The Arctic is increasingly a passable sea route. And of course, half of it is under Russia's control.
But does the mutual admiration society between the president and Vladimir Putin help the U.S. in global interest in this way, or as Donald Trump suggests and some others as well, or is there a picture of an American president being played or naive?
First of all, I think all of that is just straight up caricature. I think what the president has done makes sense, which is out the gate during the campaign, during the transition, and now as president, he refuses to fall into the trap that says stake out this tough moral position, moralize your relationship with Moscow, declare yourself to be Putin's enemy, and then you'll get some kind of, political cookies here at home.
With respect, Matt, it's much less than that. It's not that he's staked out a moral position against Russia. He's positively affirmed Vladimir Putin and drew moral equivalency on Sunday that the whole country heard between the United States and Russia. Is that the way you see
things?
Well,
my personal view is that the United States government and the Russian government are not morally equal. But I strongly oppose the idea that your starting point for doing foreign policy should be a question of who is good and who is evil.
But he's saying Vladimir Putin is good, so he's right there. He's saying Putin is good. He's strong. He's the admirable one. We've heard on many occasions.
I have never heard him say that Putin is good, and I want to be very
clear. He said he's a good, strong leader. I can play you 16 pieces of tape on that front.
Well, Tom, we can just disagree about that.
You can't really. It's a matter of factual
record.
No, you
can't disagree. Matt, come on. He said, I respect Putin. He respects the guy that meddled in our election. He respects the guy that annexed territory in Ukraine. You can work with Putin. I've worked with Putin. You can pursue all those national interests that Matthew just described, but you don't need to praise him. And I think where I think he's wrong.
Mike, I disagree with you. I don't think you can
listen
work
to
with
the tape,
Putin.
Man.
I don't think. Well, listen. There's no point in debating what's on tape. Play what's
no,
on tape.
That's
but
right.
I don't
okay,
think you can
fight.
Work with. I don't think you can work with Putin if the main statements coming out of your mouth is he's a terrible guy, he's morally wrong.
Oh, but nobody's saying it. You're conjuring that.
Nobody's
we're just
that.
Looking at what has been said.
Well,
what's the opportunity
if
here?
If I may, on Sunday, Vice President Pence was asked twice by a host on, I think it was Face the Nation, but I might be wrong about that, to say yes or no, is America morally superior to Russia? And when he then tried to sort of frame the administration's foreign policy, I think more rationally by saying, look, our values are very important. We lead with our values, you know, but we're going to try and cooperate with the Russians in areas where we can, which I think makes very mm-hmm. good sense. The host went back on him again and said, but you can't say, yes, America's morally superior to Russia. You start the conversation with any country, whether it's Russia or China or anybody else, by saying you are bad and you are wrong and you are evil and we are good and right and we stand for what is right.
You keep going back
and
to that, and that's
up.
Not where our president has set this conversation. He said you are strong and successful. Our president here is not. It's just a different starting point. I guess the question, what about Ukraine right now? Is Donald Trump right when last summer he was saying, you know, when I'm in there and I'm stronger than President Obama, Putin's not going to go into Ukraine. How do you see that right now, Matt?
Look, I mean, Russian-backed separatists are in Ukraine. Russia has occupied and annexed Crimea. Those are facts. What I heard, and you read, I think, the quote earlier from Trump, you know, part of that quote, and this is, there's a real partisan lens in the debate about, of course, the president, right? I mean, our politics is partisan. But increasingly, and this is very troubling to me as a Russia analyst, about the debate about Russia, part of what the president said was a recognition of the stakes of what is at stake in Ukraine for European security, and then an openness to having a negotiation about that. And the key issue here that I think is forgotten over and over is that the reason at the end of the day that this conflict matters so much for the United States is about European security and order, and ultimately about global order. But global order isn't something that just exists. There's not a rule book that says, this is global order, you either sign up to it or you don't. Global order is what countries do. And given that the Russians are behaving in ways, as are other countries like China, and I think in some cases the United States as well, that have undermined global order, it's pretty clear we have got to get to the negotiating table because we can't bludgeon and force these major actors with major military power, economic power, and other to simply comply with our idea of what global order is. We've got to renegotiate these basic terms.
Ambassador McFaul, the Ukraine situation right now, and for that matter, European security as well, and how President Trump has approached this, what you see Russia doing right now, where it's headed.
So just a couple of comments. First of all, Vladimir Putin would never assign moral equivalency between Russia and the United States. He never talks that way. He talks about his country being unique and rallying his people. That's the first thing. Second, I just disagree that this debate is partisan. The debate is really within the Republican Party. You heard Ambassador Haley say, you know, her first speech at the United Nations mm-hmm. sounded almost exactly like Samantha Powers. I thought maybe she was reading the old talking points. And that is because, and Secretary Mattis and others I know personally have a different view than the president. And that's because there is a global order book, Matthew, I actually think. And you know, principle number one is thou shall not annex the territory of thy neighbor. And when you violate that, we can't just say, well, let's just get along. Let's figure out a way to cooperate. There has to be some cost assigned to that, because if you don't, my view is that's when the global order begins to fall apart. When we all just say might makes right, and you know, you can violate that. And I would agree that when we've done it in the past, we have weakened the global order as well. But two wrongs don't make a right. And moving forward, we have to think about that in a serious way, that these things, like, you know, annexing territory, bombing Aleppo to smithereens, and interfering in our elections, those are all three things that I think go beyond the norms of our society. And if we don't push back on them, we risk that society being destroyed.
Mike Mufal, what's happening right now in Ukraine? I mean, we had the president talking with Vladimir Putin over that weekend, and the next thing we knew, there was shelling in Ukraine. Why now?
Well, there's speculation that, you know, they're pushing to see how the Trump administration might respond. I'm not sure about that. And actually, here I do agree with Matt that at the end of the day, we have to negotiate with Russia about Ukraine. We can't. Neither can we just walk away, nor do we have military options there.
What would that negotiation look like? Because so far, Ukraine lost Crimea, and now it appears, you know, there's some risk of it losing more. So what's the negotiation?
I personally am not optimistic. If I had to predict rather than to advocate, I think we're going to basically the status quo, what you see today, will be around for a long time. But I would hope that the Trump administration would take a new run, you know, a harder look to try to implement at a minimum the Minsk Accord. Maybe they have some more creative ideas to get Russia out of eastern Ukraine.
That's sanctions.
Well, I you know, diplomacy is a combination of engagement and coercive instruments. Mm-hmm. I want to give them some time to figure out their policy. Like I said, I don't think they've had yet mm-hmm. a discussion of their Russia policy or Ukraine policy. But the goal is clear. The goal is that Russia needs to exit and stop supporting separatists in eastern Ukraine.
Matthew Rojanski, you think we're on a path to potential better relations with Russia, in fact, or Mike McCall says, be careful, don't be naive or you'll end up worse off.
Well, it's hard to disagree with not being naive. The question is, what does that mean? I think the biggest problem with U.S. policy towards Russia for the 25 years of the post-Cold War is that we either imagine that we are the victors, we are more powerful and we can bludgeon the Russians into doing what we want, or that somehow the Russians are going to change and transform, be Democrats and be our dearest friends and do what we want out of their close agreement with us. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Matthew Rojanski, director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, thank you very much for being with us today. And Ambassador Michael McFaul, author of Russia's Unfinished Revolution, with us today from Stanford, California, and the Hoover Institution there. Ambassador McFaul, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.